Hey, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Rusik Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to the local music scene and beyond.
Today we have Jeremy Ivey. Jeremy is a singer-songwriter and guitar player based here out of Nashville.
If you are listening to this episode on Spotify or any other platform, you're going to want to head on over to our YouTube channel at Rusik Podcast. Over there, you can check out live performances with our guests, including today's guest, Jeremy Ivey. Go check those out. Give those videos a like. Subscribe to the channel. Ring that notification bell. All that stuff helps us out a ton. Thank you. Enjoy.
The only thing it can do is it can take information that exists and they can shuffle that and then put it out in different forms. So the one defense that you have as a creator against AI is just that the fact that anyone that's created anything that ended up being original, they had to do it from their own brain and their own heart and soul. So AI can't do that. So it could give you, if you're like, hey, give me the next Dua Lipa single, it could do that.
Yeah.
And by using whatever Dua Lipa singles have come out and scanning that and making something. But if there's, maybe her next single is going to be like really mind blowing and like, you know, like her version of like Strawberry Fields or something, you know, like, whoa, you know? Yeah. So if that is the case, AI can do that because they can't know your next move, you know?
Yeah.
I've tried it with like deeper songwriting. I've been like, hey, give me a Bob Dylan song on this avenue. And it just picks off like tropes, you know, just like when you're knocking on heaven's door and you're just like, oh God. Like,
I don't write lyrics, but I've tried really it for like composing like instrumental stuff and hey, this is my chord progression. Like, how could I follow this up with? Or how can I lead from this chord and this chord? And it always just gives you, like, super generic, uninteresting, solutions.
The most obvious, like, well, if you're at a G7, you can go to C next.
It's always, like, the super vanilla shit. Yeah.
And the thing that I think is also interesting about it as well is, to me, the reason I love art, whatever facet of art it is, whether it's songwriting or films or novels, is because someone is trying to express something, even if they're not entirely sure of where that's coming from, and none of us really are, it's that process of watching someone or experiencing someone try to express something.
Yeah.
And by definition, I mean, AI isn't art because it's not doing that. It's not actually trying to. It just, as you're saying, it's just compositing all of this information outside of itself. And so it's this weird thing where it's like it almost looks like it's the shell of art. Like it has that sort of facade of, oh, okay, this melody is catchy or these words are well put together, but it doesn't. It's like there's nothing behind it. Like there's nothing actually underneath the shell. It's a very strange thing to, and who knows? I mean, with the way technology moves, we might get to a point very quickly where I think there's a threshold. I think there's a line that people aren't aware of with that because it's so innate in us. I think we can just recognize when something is made by a human mind.
I don't think there's any real thing. People that we consider, either in visual mediums or in audio mediums, or whatever, written word. Anyone that we consider to be a legend or someone important in the world has always been trying to screw with you with their next move and the next thing, some surprising thing. Yeah. Go from Shakespeare to David Bowie to anyone. It's like there's things that they did. You're like, oh, you know, and they're kind of trying to fuck you over with it. You know, like, going back to the Beatles, if the Beatles didn't have John Lennon always trying to step on your feet and like everything is like, what, this? And, you know, here's a song with one chord. Like, that is something that AI can't do. They can't like predict unpredictable things. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone that we admire in the history of art has been doing unpredictable things and screwing with our brain and making us be like, first hate it and be like, actually, that's pretty good.
That's a really good way of phrasing. Like one of the things I actually wanted to ask you about is really related to this. Like one of the things that I think is really beautiful about your songwriting, when I listen to your albums, there is this beautiful line that's tread of surprise versus what's expected with your melodies. Mm-hmm. And your melodies ride that line so well of you think you know where you're going in this direction, but really we're going to go over here. Or it kind of leads you in this way that is very, very difficult, I think. I think it's a kind of melody writing that's really, really hard. And I think that is something that, that is very difficult for AI to be able to do. I think what you do in songwriters like yourself, it's very, very hard for a program in that way to even get into that realm, because
he's
it's
just
very
saying difficult. That I'm unmarketable because that's
no.
But it's true, because that's like something that I've always dealt with. We're like, what genre are you, or what?
Yeah,
where does
yeah.
this fit into? And I mean, for better or worse, being original is being kind of unmarketable because. Mm-hmm. But thank
that's
you.
A beautiful way of saying that. Yeah,
yeah. Being unmarketable is great. It's like it's like kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I respect people that win Grammys, and I respect. All that. I don't really love awards for music or art, because it's kind of like,
I feel the same way.
My favorite album of the year might have no bearing on anyone else. So, you know, the point is, like, it's almost an insult if you win like a ton of Grammys, because you have to be generic enough to appeal to enough people. I tried to explain this to my son, who's now able to understand it. When he's younger, he'd always be like, I like this because it's the most popular thing, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he was super into Mr. Beast and all this stuff. I was like, well, he's got, like, millions of followers. I'm like, okay. But I was like, let's talk burgers. I was like, McDonald's has the most sold burgers per year. Do you like a McDonald's burger, or do you like a Gabby's burger better? And he's like, I like Gabby's burger better. I'm like, it's just a better burger, right? Yeah. Well, why is it not selling as much as McDonald's? He's like, well, no one knows about it. I'm like, there you go.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So the most popular thing, the most Grammy-winning thing, maybe back in the 70s or 60s, it might have been pretty good. Nowadays, it's just kind of like the thing that sells the most units and is the most well-known thing in the world, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, it's like water or bread. Everyone, you know, ingests it, but not everybody's into snails. And
yeah.
Maybe I'm a snail. So.
And music is something that is also, I do think that there's something truly innate. It's an innate need for us. We need music, and we need art in some capacity to go through life, I think, or at least most of us do. And yeah, it's very strange when people, I think there's a lot of people in life that I find, and it's almost sort of an uncomfortable realization, I think, as I go through life, when I realize that most people, they don't think about art in the same way that that I or my musician friends or even just people that that I love in life think about art, where mm-hmm. it is this sort of sacred part of being alive. It's something that really brings meaning and value into life. I think to a lot of people, it doesn't really function on that level. I think for a lot of people, it just turn on the car radio and like whatever's on is on, that kind of thing. And I'm sure that you know, when we're talking about Grammys or whatever, I'm sure a lot of it sort of plays to lowest common denominator in that way. But I wonder why that is, because I think for myself, it's one of the most beautiful parts of being alive, is get to experience. It's the closest I'm ever going to get to being in your mind or being in your mind. Like there's nothing else comparable. So I it makes me sad when I think that a great many people just don't have that relationship to the stuff people make.
Well, mainstream music is pushed out so many different emotions that existed in this music when I was even a kid. Like when I was a kid, even the 80s and 90s, there was sad songs on the radio. And I think like if you lose someone that you love, you know, and you are a person that listens only to the radio, you don't really delve into other stuff. So you just lost a friend and you're driving in your car and you're switching radio stations trying to find something you relate with. You're not going to relate with, you know, I Had Some Help by like Post Malone. You're going to relate with something that's like really sad and really dark, that's going to bring you to kind of dealing with those feelings. And in the 90s, even maybe the last period of time, this is real, but you would turn on either country or whatever, you'd hear like a sad song.
I'm just going to pause you for a moment if that's all right. I think that's a wild statement, because that is completely correct. I've never thought about that in my life. Like, when was the last time you turned on the radio and there was a sad song? That's actually kind of blowing my mind. Yeah, I don't know why that's kind of freaking me out.
Yeah,
but
I never thought about that.
That's very odd.
Well, to me, it's telling the entire world, from a mainstream standpoint, let's not feel things besides like horny and happy. You know, horny and happy are very important. They're great feelings. You know, but also the reason I think sad music and sad things are so important is because sadness makes happiness relevant. Because there's no mm-hmm. way you can, we all know this, like if you felt happy all the time, it would be feeling normal. Mm-hmm. If you felt sad all the time, it would be feeling normal. We need the two things to balance out.
You need the relativity.
So I think that's something that I actually thought about a couple of days ago, and I think might be what's wrong with music. Not the genre style of the music people are making. I don't care if people use auto-tune or they use like studio tricks, but you're not like the emotions aren't being conveyed with the human emotions that we have, which is a big expansive palette. Mm-hmm. Are not being expressed on pop radio. It's just like two things, you know?
Yeah, that spectrum of human experience is so wide. And that to me, that's something that I find can be frustrating in songwriting. I adore songwriting. It's my favorite thing in the world. But I do find that oftentimes, and I think that this has gotten, at least in popular music, it has gotten more monotone over time. But
yeah.
There's so much to express in music that oftentimes, in other arts, novels, films, etc., you can touch on more of that spectrum. Whereas in film, or excuse me, in music, it can really kind of be pigeonholed to kind of what you're talking about. There's happy songs, there's sad songs, or there used to be, and there's just so much other stuff to touch upon that, like, I again, like, some of my favorite songwriters, the quirky songwriters, the songwriters that can come at things from a different angle, I think they can touch on all of that human experience in ways that are slanted, that make you sort of, oh, I didn't realize you could do this in that way. And kind of to your point earlier, I think that's where.
It's the soda water, guys. Okay,
it's all right.
That's another thing we learned very, very fast with doing this. Like, okay, maybe these aren't the best drinks to be giving people.
Was
like,
for the podcast.
But yeah, I think that's something that when I see that in songwriting, I love it. I love seeing folks who can touch on all of those different parts of the palette, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a ballsy thing to do, for lack of a better term, you know.
Well, and the 90s are a good example. So you can go through almost every genre in the 90s and pick out some really sad songs. It wasn't just like, oh, folk music was sad in the 90s. It was like mainstream rock was sad a couple of times. There were definitely some sad country songs in the 90s. Even in like R&B, remember like that guy Babyface had some like finger picking sort of sad. Boyz II Men had some sad, rip your heart out songs. Those were like top 10 songs, you know? Like, for some reason in the 90s was the last period of time where we actually enjoyed feeling those things in a big way across the board. I'm not a big like Pearl Jam fan, but they had that song Black that made people kind of like cry, like, why couldn't I be with you? And like, there's longing in it. And I just mentioned like four genres, and in rap too. In rap in the 90s, there would be, if someone lost someone, especially if it was a public thing like Biggie or Tupac, there would be a song about it, and everyone would kind of like grieve together and be like, oh man, we miss, you know.
Yeah, like, whomever that may be, it's sort of a,
that was the thing that would happen, and that would, depression would sell records back then. It still would, but they just don't let people through.
I wonder. Oh, sorry, Brian.
Why do you think that's not the case now? That the range of human emotion is.
I think it's
narrowed.
All about monetization, as far as like how many records the horny happy stuff selling.
Yeah.
Versus the depressing stuff. Like, you know, if you have a sad song, it might sell like a million downloads or whatever in a month. But if you have like a banger, like club song, that might sell like four, you know, and they just weed out the stuff that isn't working the best.
Well, it's like if you're running a restaurant, it's like, okay, are we going to have 57 things on the menu that we have to, you know, buy ingredients for and figure out how we're going to prepare all this stuff? Or do we want to do five things that we know are going to sell? It makes sense. Again, from a business perspective, it makes total sense. When you're mixing that with art, gives you not the best outcome.
I think music and food, it's weirdly enough, because that's what I did before I started doing music for a living, was I was a cook and a chef. But,
oh, really?
But they do have these weird parallels. Like a menu would be like a list of like what's being rotated on the radio, you know? Mm-hmm. In country music, famously, I forget the guy's name, but he always said that, you know, women were the tomatoes in the salad. You could take them or leave them. We didn't really need them, you know. And still to this day, the reason that my wife like started fighting that whole thing was because that was true. And when she first came around in, say, 2015, 2016, she used to wear this shirt that I think the first time she was ever in Rolling Stone was because he would say, you know, the tomato thing. And so she had a shirt that said, you say tomato, I say fuck you, you know. But but it's true now. It's almost the same now. Mm-hmm. So think about people on country radio right now, women. Mm-hmm. It's like Lainey Wilson. There's like two more. everyone else is men still. So nothing has changed. No matter how much you bang your head against the wall of country music, they're going to be like, nope, it's dudes. That sells more. It's not sad songs. It's, you know. But to give depth to the whole thing, and the thing with sad songs, going back to like why they do it, and it, you know, it's always money. But really and truly, if you look at the numbers, a lot of the sad songs in the late 90s or 2000s were the ones that got the most requests on the radio. You know, the ones that were like, whether it would be Faith Hill or whatever, they'd be like, I want to hear that song because it does something to me.
It tears my heart out, yeah.
And so even though the other ones might be selling more units across the board, radio play was kind of going to the more, you know. But now that that's all cleared out, there is no sad songs to be even chosen. And you have to go request. I mean, think about the 90s. Like, Elliott Smith had a hit called Miss Misery that was on the radio that got an Oscar nomination. Like, that's insane to think about now.
Yeah.
There would never be that kind of.
This is, it's so funny. This is something I've never really meditated on. It's just never, that thought's never occurred to me. But in pop music, that's just not something we're dealing with right now.
I wonder if that's just like a reflection of us being more emotionally reserved as a society.
I'm sure it can be a lot
closed
of things.
Off, closed off?
Yeah. I do feel like people probably are more like closed off than they used to be back in pre-social media and iPhones. And
But I'm sure also, I mean, Brian knows I'm the forever optimist, but I'm sure also, as much as, you know, right now, sort of the conversation is focusing on that central point of pop music and how that can seem to dominate the world, but there is, I mean, just there's so much other stuff out there. Largely thanks to technology. I mean, the fact that we can get all this stuff out to people. I think that if nothing else, maybe that allows some place in the market for these other things outside of pop music to take up those, to really capitalize on those emotions that aren't being utilized by pop music. I mean, there's so much for that.
Something, and you're right, like that, you know, there is more of an opportunity with grassroots now because you can, Jesse Wells is a good example. You can kind of like do your own thing, go on TikTok and play your song and not really do much else. You don't have to be like, hey guys, like and subscribe. You just go on and play your songs and at some point doors were open. But go back to the radio, and why are the gatekeepers still in charge of the radio? Why is it the people like Jesse Wells who have like millions of followers selling out shows across the, why is he not playing the radio? There are a certain sort of gatekeeping going on where if your music is political or crosses any of these lines that we don't like, the whole world can be like, this is awesome. I'm going to the show. All my friends are going. We love this. But if it, I really don't know. I know in country music, it's more old fashioned, but why even in hip hop and mainstream rock or whatever, why are we not able to, like, MJ Letterman, he's great. He's not on the radio either. He might be on like college radio, but I'm talking about mainstream radio where you have four channels. You got Jack FM. You got, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I still do think like people like that probably still wouldn't appeal to like a mainstream audience. They just find their kind of thing. The people that do that, it does appeal to, like on social media. You know,
I don't know, and I also wonder how much of it is just, and not in a conspiratorial sense. I wonder how much of it is just sort of the gatekeepers, and by their own function of what they do, not wanting to acknowledge that maybe this is the direction people want to move things in. And when you have those gatekeepers in place where, okay, well, this is what I've done. This is what we've done for however many decades now. This is the business model that we think works. It can be a difficult decision for someone to like make that leap and say, okay, well, we're going to go in this direction now. So, I mean, some of it, I'm sure you can maybe chalk up to human nature and just that kind of fear of wanting to make those leaps. But I don't know. I'm sure a lot of it is just that sort of cross-contamination between business in a way, in the way that,
Country genre is the easiest for me to figure all this stuff out with because I think they're the most like blatant and obvious about what they do.
Yeah.
I think it comes down to one thing.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Both. I think it comes down to one thing with this. I think it's danger. Mm-hmm. The reason these people are not allowed on the radio is because they're dangerous. And the 90s, there was people on the radio that were dangerous, and I think they figured out this doesn't work. Some people that are dangerous that are on the radio in the 90s, some of them killed themselves. Some of them did whatever, went down bad roads or did drugs or whatever, you know. With country, you think about someone like I love Chris Stapleton. He's a friend, and he's awesome. He's been let in the radio world, you know. So he's one of the people I would consider like a roots artist, probably more influenced by blues and even country, who's a great artist and writes good songs, and he's on the radio, you know. Then you have someone like Sergio Simpson, who also has sold tons of records and got Grammys, and, you know, he's well-lauded from the throwback country crowd. He kind of started the whole scene that Chris fit into, that Margot fit into. So Sergio really is, like, to thank for, like, this resurgence of real country music, you know? Yet, he's not allowed in the CMAs. He's not allowed on country radio. Why is that? Because he says stuff. He says stuff, you know, like he'll say whatever's on his mind. He's dangerous. You can't trust him. He might go to the AMAs and like throw over some tables and because he's got that attitude, you know. Yeah. It's like, and that's the thing that scares people. And I think it comes down to that simple thing is that if you, they can't control you, they don't want you in their room. Mm-hmm. They want people that are easy to control. And some of the people that are easy to control, I like their music, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not like making fun of them. I'm just saying they've decided to not be troublemakers, you know, and, which gives the whole outlaw thing kind of a funny tinge, because the only people that are really considered outlaw and outlaw country now are people that don't do anything wrong. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So I think if you look at country, that's probably the same with every other genre, with hip hop, with well, with jazz, they're all weirdos. But you know what I mean, though? It's like the rebellion thing, I think, is the fear. You know,
I think people that make interesting stuff, regardless of what that stuff is, they're often going to be the people that you don't know what they're going to do next. If you don't know what they're going to do next creatively, you probably don't know what they're going to do next when you're, you know, sitting in a room like this with them. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's just, I mean, almost in my mind by just sort of the fact of who they are. And so if you're wanting to, you know, again, as a business, if you're wanting to interplay with that, yeah, there is that feeling of danger to that. Yeah. But we need that in the world. Like, that's something that's hugely important, especially for art.
Upstarts out there that are starting out, my suggestion would be do like the Beatles did. Go in just softball pitches, you know, just easy, poppy, fun.
And then looking get good. Weird.
And then when you're in the door, and the door is locked behind you, then bust it all open.
The greatest quote on this is when Bob Dylan said, you know, I'd gotten in the door when no one was looking, and I was in there now, and there was nothing anyone from then on could ever do about it.
If people know about you, then you're
there. Yeah, you can do whatever you want. You have your audience.
That's beautiful. One, when you're writing, when you're creating music, how much of the sort of not just the sort of musical, political world, all of that, but how much of genre, how much of sort of that pigeonholing of ideas is in your mind? Do you think of yourself as a particular type of songwriter, or is it just you're the culmination of all the different shit that you love? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't would consider myself any sort of songwriter. I just think that when it comes time to write a song, I feel this like kind of pull in my chest, and I never know what that means. It might just be like I've come up with a melody, and then now I have to figure out the puzzle of putting words to that I don't hate, you know. But it usually comes from listening to music. It's all the influences that we all have, you know. It's so you can be on the way home from somewhere and you can turn something on that'll kind of... The other day I was listening to Lucinda Williams, and I think everyone gives her credit for being she's a great lyricist. But I really enjoy, on her first few records, her timing and her melodic sense, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think she gets enough credit for her. Where, say, you got a chord progression, it's like it's an E, it's a C-sharp minor, it goes back to E, and then it goes to A. Well, she'll go, you would start singing on the E, she goes E, nothing, and the C-sharp minor, she starts singing. Mm-hmm. And then when it goes back to E into the A, you have a whole different feeling of where you would put a melody. Yeah. So stuff like that sometimes will trigger something. We're like, okay, I'm going to come up with my own three or four chords. I'm going to do that, where I'm going to wait three chords into it and then start singing, you know.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah, there's all that kind of stuff. It can be that simple. Like Bob Dylan, it could be some line that you mishear or you hear. And then you're like, that will trigger like a lyrical thing. And mm-hmm. I'll go down and jot down stuff. And then I have to figure out how to make that into melodic, you know. So I think it's different every time. I don't even know if that's the question you're asking.
Absolutely. But I know for myself as a songwriter as well, it's it's even, it feels silly asking certain songwriting questions, because I know for myself there's no answer. I mean, we all have our processes that we can maybe see the most regularly, but you know, every time that one shows up, you're dealing with, it's like it's the first time. I mean, yeah. And you try to set up your life and routine, at least I do, in a way where you can, when you get a bite on the line, you like to think you know what to do next, mm-hmm. but you're never really sure how big that fish is. You know, like you just don't know. And so there is that fun play with it, I think. That's such a, I know for myself, for my own sort of mental sanity, I think it's a really healthy thing in life to have that passion and love and commitment to something, whilst also acknowledging that there's a part of this that's just going to be out of my hands, and I have to just learn to ride the wave, you know?
You just gotta, you know, transcribe the man as it comes through, but mm-hmm. I don't know if y'all are this way too, and as I get older, it's less so, but it still happens, mm-hmm. where, I mean, one, I'm in my mid to late 40s, and I'm still, like, in love with the process of writing. I'm not, like, bored of it. It still blows my mind every time it happens, but, I got a broke cone. I could feel it.
I still get. We gotta get rid of these things. I say that as I'm like, "Do you want another one?"
I get obsessive. Uh-huh. So, especially if it's a good one, and I can feel it coming on. So there's times where I'll come up with something, and usually it's like the first verse and chorus or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's the first like little bit of it, and I'll play it for the wife, and I always kind of have to play it for her because I can tell by her reaction whether it's good or not, you know? Mm-hmm. And if it's really good, she's going to want to be a part of it. She's going to, let me help you write that, you know? So like the other day I had this thing, it was a good melody, had a couple good lines, you know, mm-hmm. I wasn't sure where it was going to go. She's like, let me help you with that. But she's busy like crazy, and I'm not. I mean, I'm with the kids, but I have moments in the day when they're at school. I don't have a lot of this stuff going on where I'm doing a lot of media. Mm-hmm. I'm just our songwriter, so she'll be like, I want to work on that, but like, I'll save it for you. But she knows if I got that look in my eye, as soon as she leaves the room, I'll be like, okay, like, you know, because if I'm really obsessed with it, then I can't help it.
Yeah,
you know?
Oh, totally. It's the best feeling things, in the world. Yeah, I love that. Yeah,
one of the worst things for her is like, she'll leave and go do something, and she'll come back, and I'll just kind of seem like a little more happy and calm. And she's like, you fucking finish it, didn't you? I'm like, well, yeah. I was like, you can change it if you want. And she's like, read it. I'm like, no, it's perfect. Like,
yeah, it's like, the best.
That's the best. What's not the best is when you have that first part, you can't get to the next, mm-hmm. you can't cross the next bridge. Like, where, like, okay, I have a pretty good chorus, but where does the story go? What's verse mm-hmm. 2 and 3? It's like, you know, and then you sit on it too long. That's, and then like a week later, you have no idea who
that's like, always been my struggle. I'll always come up with one section that's really good and then just can't for the life of me figure out the next part.
I think you have to finish it then.
That's what I'm learning.
I've had the exact opposite experience in life because I was going to ask, do you feel like there's an expiration date for those things in the sense that when you get it, do you feel like just hammer it out now?
But I've finished stuff that's been a couple years old that I forgot about and I mm-hmm. went through my phone and heard demos.
Yeah.
Like, that's really good. So I think sometimes, but I think definitely that first burst, if you're planning on a verse 3 and the first two verses come out quickly, you got to push on.
You got to get out as much as you can.
In your own mental
it's there somewhere.
Vocabulary, it's there for you. Uh-huh. And once you close enough doors, you can't remember which hallway it was down. You
know? I always imagine it like puzzle pieces coming through a door.
Yeah.
And I think for myself, you know, I used to think, The ones that I put together in 60 seconds that show up, and because we've all experienced that few and far between in our life, but it's occurred where in one moment there's not something there, and in the next moment there is, and you don't know how that occurs. You don't know how you sit down, and all of a sudden that song is there. I used to think that those were the songs that were the best quality, that those were the songs that for whatever reason were better than the other ones that took 2 weeks, a couple months, you know. And I think as I've done this more, I've come to the realization for myself that, oh, those puzzle pieces just kind of come through the door at different times. That being said, in my mind, I do know that there's a pile in the back of the room of just shit that I know I'm never going to get to. Okay, is it going to become one of those things?
Well, again, if you're not obsessed about it, maybe it's not that important. But I think that one, speaking of Bob Dylan, and always a good person to go to as far as literary kind of forms of storytelling. This might not be a good example, because what I'm going to give as an example is one of his songs that actually Jacques Levy helped him write, and he's a playwright, so maybe he came up with this idea.
Yeah.
Either way, Dylan's done it before. I think the last verse of a song, if you're telling a story, should add a new perspective. I think that there's a song called Black Diamond Bay on Desire that's, to most people, a throwaway song. It's a very long song. It's got some crazy like imagery and this. It's like this weird, like apocalyptic resort that's like there's volcanoes erupting and everything's going crazy. But the last verse, it's all from perspective of you being in the shit that's happening. The last verse, he removes himself and he's watching the report of it on the news. So it's like, you know, I'm sitting at home one night watching old Cronkite on the 11 o'clock news, whatever. He goes, didn't seem much be happening, so I went to grab another beer. So he's like, he's not even the guy that's there. He's just like, this seems lame, you know? Yeah. I love that removal. And I've used it before. Like, one of the songs that I played, the story of one called Runner, you realize in the last verse that he's telling it from prison. But you don't get the sense that he's telling it from prison on the first verse.
Mm-hmm.
He's just saying, like, man, I did this last year. I started running drugs for my cousin. And then he's like, you know, time passes slow. Then you're like, oh, I'm incarcerated.
And it's this beautiful thing when people can pull this off. I think what you're talking about goes beyond the form of songwriting. I think we see this in a lot of different forms of storytelling. But I love that when, in one sense, it becomes cyclical in a way. It's almost a cyclical structure of storytelling. But it's cyclical, though, at the end. You do have that different vantage point, and it's maybe not an aha moment. It's not like the story is revealed in any sense, but you have a deeper understanding of you have a new perspective on what came before.
Yeah.
And I think that's so, so powerful.
I think it's refreshing for the brain, just to, even like you say, it's not like an aha moment. It's at least like, okay, now I can see this from another angle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, I'm going to go back to the early 60s, and there was stuff in the 50s that was storytelling that way, you know, that was really good. But if you go from, like, the classic love pop song, I'm going to talk about the Beatles again, because She Loves You was a big moment, because back then you didn't say she thinks this about you. It was like, I love you, or you are wrong to me, and that's the only perspectives there ever were in, like, pop love songs. Like, hey, you did me wrong.
Unless you're Chuck Berry.
Yeah, he told stories for sure. And there was some stuff in the 50s, like I said, like,
beautiful stuff.
Last
yeah,
Kiss,
yeah.
Leader of the Pack, that had stories of tragic kind of things. But, you know, as far as love songs go, it was like, hey, this girl told me that she's into you. And that never really happened. So I think that when you go down the line and you get to the Bob Dylans, and that was all from folk music, and there was definitely different perspectives and tales in folk music. And I don't know. I think if you're going to tell a story, you know, it can be compelling or not. But if you stay in the same thing, and you have like seven verses that are all from the same perspective, kind of say the same thing. Like, that's a good way to like, I know this because I have a six-year-old. It's a good way to put a kid to sleep, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I also found just on
monotony,
the sort of...
Monotony.
Yeah, and I find on a mechanical level when I'm writing that, you know, there is the sort of trope of, okay, bringing it back to the first verse, and that's sort of the lazy man's. Like, you know, if you forget your last verse, just sing the first verse again, that sort of thing. And a lot of folks do that, and I'm not putting that down, but for myself, I find that, and it's probably just because I'm crazy, but if I want to do something in that realm, usually I want to change something. Usually if I come back to that initial idea, even if I'm not trying to alter perspective, I want to alter the form in enough of a way that I'm still projecting, I'm still pushing the can further down the road, you know, as opposed to just...
Or, you know, what if you do the exact same verse as the first verse, maybe something that came before that will make you now have different perspective on that first verse. Yeah. And now it means something different because of what just happened, you know?
Yeah.
That can be cool too, but
that's fantastic. One thing I want to ask you too, something that music is such a hard life for people to commit to. I mean, I say that in one sense, I guess it's not, because I feel so lucky that I have music. I mean, I love the fact that, like, you know, we have this thing in our life that we just adore. I think I feel just so blessed to have that, because a lot of people maybe don't have that sort of thing. But I know how difficult that can be for people. For yourself, you know, you have that. Your wife has that. How do you?
It's gonna keep burping. I also haven't eaten yet, so everything in my stomach is just this. So it's just like. But go ahead. Sorry.
No, I apologize. How for you and your wife, how do you do that with a partner in that sense? Because that's an experience I've never had of two of you tackling a very, very difficult way of life together. How have you managed to do that and hopefully stay a happy person?
Yeah, I mean, happiness is not something you can count on, but yeah, I don't know. It's I get that from a lot of people. A lot of people are like, how in the world, you know? But it's been so long. I mean, I've been with her for almost 22 years, so it's been so long. I can't really remember it not being that way. But I do know when we first met, we both wrote separately. We didn't do the same things. You know, I had, like, a little band. She was kind of playing solo in town. And, of course, you know, I was 24 and she was 20, so we were very young. But I don't know. I think it was one point after about 3 or 4 years of knowing each other, we sat down and she had a song she couldn't get to the end of, and I kind of started helping her. And you can say, like, you know, when you meet someone, it's like, oh, I'm into this person. Well, you know, why? Like, well, I have these things in common, you know? So that's the basis of it. We both were complete losers. Our parents didn't agree with us being what we were, doing what we were doing. She dropped out of college. I said no to college. We weren't the greatest examples of our families, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think having that that thing is real. And so we started going to open mics, and we liked the same. It wasn't just music. If we had quit doing music, it would have been fine, because we liked the same art and movies, and we liked doing the same, you know, going on hikes and sitting in, you know, rainy bookstores and going through weird poetry together. And, you know, we had all these things in common, so it wasn't just one thing. And but that one thing became like our living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I spent most of my, I would say, years of that I could have probably developed my own career. I was smart enough to know that because of my singing abilities, that she was probably the one that was going to make some money if anyone was, you know. So I switched all my kind of focus to, like, we had a rock and roll band for a while. But even that, I didn't sing. It was like her, you know, we wrote together. Which is kind of funny, because when people know her, they think of country, and I always go back to Dolly Parton. She had, like, a doo-wop band before, you know, mm-hmm. And it's like, but Margot has that gear she can go to. She can sing rock and roll. She can kind of, like, embody that, because that was more natural to her before country. Country's just standing there doing this, you know, and she's the type of person who grabs a mic off and goes around, you know. But yeah, just that was just kind of what we were focused on. It was like, we have to do this. And this was make money at making music that wasn't shitty, that we believed in. Mm-hmm. And the make money in music part would have been way easier if we didn't have the second part that we believed in, that we didn't want to slit our wrists over.
Yeah.
I think one time we had an opportunity to go write some, like, Music Row tunes with this guy. He was like, yeah, come down here. And we were so embarrassed of the thought that we were, like, using pen names, you know. I was Sam Pickens, and she was Sylvia Slim, which is really dorky. But so together, if our, you know, co-write would be Slim Pickens, you know.
That's great.
But so we would. I remember one time we went into this room, the couple of the writers, and it was just awful what they were coming up with. And we got so annoyed with it that we started, like, fucking with them and throwing out song titles that, like, we thought would never work. Like, how about Truck Balls? We got a song called Truck Balls. And they're like, what do you mean? You know those things that hang in truck? Like, we got a song about that. Like, my fucking truck balls, you know? And of course, they kind of liked it, but, you know.
Why is integrity important in art?
it's not important to everybody. I think a lot of times it's like making a buck is important. And again, like there's certain people and certain artists that got through the door making a buck and then became themselves because they were smart. We should have done that. We didn't do that. We were headstrong from the beginning and wanted to do our own thing and do it the way we liked it. And that's why it took her and me both about 13 years before she got signed to Third Man or anything happened, you know. A long time of us playing to nobody and playing dive bars. We used to have a band called Secret Handshake. It was all these weird political kind of kink sort of songs. And we would clear rooms in Nashville. It was pretty fun.
We've all had those gigs.
Like, our friend would throw us on a bill with like a bunch of other country artists, and we'd get up there with this like kind of like loud, like jangly rock and roll, talking about, like, I think we had a song called Architects of War. You know, and just people just broke, you know. Like,
when you're experiencing those moments in life where you do clear the room, or where you're playing to four people, four of which are at the bar drunk.
Yeah.
Why keep doing that? I know I ask that because I feel like we all have our own answers for that. But why is that thing in you so compelled to keep doing that?
Goes back to obsession. Being obsessed with it, you know, it's the only, like, sane reason to keep doing it. One time when Margo first started doing country, we toured this awful tour because we had, like, this worst, booking agency. But we played this festival, and it was, like, one of those festivals that's, like, it's not a festival if you're in different tiny bars all around the town. Like, that's how South By got started. It's kind of like that. It was up in the north, and we literally played for like, we had to play for like an hour and a half or 2 hours. And we played to a cutout of Kenny Chesney for like an hour and a half, you know. And it was just, that was the gig, you know. And we were still going to get paid our $500, so it didn't really matter to us. Yeah. And no one was there, but I'll never forget like that, just that one cardboard cutout and no one else in the room, you know. And sometimes that's the deal, but it's like, you curse it and you say, I'm never going to do this again. This is it. I remember at the end of that tour, we're like, we're not, this is stupid, you know. And that's actually when we quit. We were like, we're done with this. We're done with music. And then she got arrested and went to jail for like, I think it was 3 or 4 days. And then she started writing these country songs in jail. And then when she came out, she played them. I'm like, this is really good, you know. But our band was now defunct and we were just like, we're not going to do that. And that was when I was like, because it's obsessive, you know. It's like, well, we got to make an album. We got to go record these songs. And we had been through Memphis, and we had gone and toured at Sun Studios. Mm-hmm. And there was a sign, like, record your own album, which I thought was going to be this, like, cheesy thing where you go in there and you sing like an Elvis song. And you get, like, one take, and like, well, here's your disc, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it actually was this guy that was doing night sessions there, and he was serious about making records. He wasn't, like, the touristy trope guy. And that was Matt Ross Spang. And he was like, come to Memphis, I'll cut you guys a deal. I'm like, we have no money. He's like, well, just come here and record. And that's when I sold our car. We had a little Mini Cooper. And it wasn't a car. It was our only car. We had a child at this point. Like, I sold our car to go make a record. And we started having to take, like, cabs and Ubers just to the grocery store for a minute. Because I remember I got like $9,000 for it, and we went to Memphis, and I think we gave like Matt Ross Spang $2,000, and then we paid the musicians that came with us, and I think at the end of the day, I think we had like $1,500 left, you know, that we ended up putting into mixing it and mastering it, which is, so all in for the whole trip and everything, it was about $9,000, you know, it's like 5 days, we did it, and then we get back home, we're like, this album's great, it's great, and then that kind of come down, and they're like, oh shit, we don't have money or a car. Like, what do we do without money or a car, you know? And so we both had like a couple like contacts, and I started working in a place that I could walk to from the house. And I think I borrowed some money from my dad so we could get to the first paycheck. And we started kind of thinking like, well, as soon as anyone hears this record, we're good, you know, this is really good. This is going to be, you know. And it was like months of like sending people. You know, like, I remember Sony was kind of interested, which was crazy. Like, oh, major label, you know. But she would go there, It'd be like five different meetings. You go the first time thinking, this is it. We're going to get signed, you know. Like, we don't like the countryness of it. Take the fiddles off. Take the whatever. Mm-hmm. And, of course, again, going back to us being hardhead, we could have just been like, okay, now give us $1 million. They'd be like, here it is, you know. But we're like, no, that's how the record, it's got fiddles and pedal steel on it, you know. Well, we can't market this, you know. Mm-hmm. Then it'd be like, okay, come back in a week later. Let's talk it over again. They go, the band would go and perform for the CEO of Sony. We like this one song, but all the rest of the songs have to be rewritten and recorded. No, this is the album, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it just went back and forth that way, and some labels would send back, like the quote would be, we've got too many girls already, or just all this like stuff we go through. And again, getting to the point where we were almost done, again, just like, mm-hmm. I can't do it. I think I was working at Duke's, and she was picking up waiting shifts. And I was like, we just can't do this. I got to get like a real job, and you know. And it was then, and we played a show at the Basement East, and Ben Swank from Third Man came, and he heard it, and he was ranting and raving at Third Man, you gotta hear this girl. And then again, we kept going in for meetings with Third Man, and then it would be like we get a babysitter, we both go in there, and then last minute he'd be like, hey, I gotta cancel today, and we're like, no, we got a babysitter, we have to come in. I think this one time we just forced our way in, like, no, we're coming, you know. And so we got there, and the whole thing, the reason they kept canceling it, because they wanted Jack to be there, because he had to make sure Margo could sing live and it wasn't just all studio stuff. Mm-hmm. So he finally shows up, and I think Ben was like stalling until he got there. And like, let's go in the next room and cut like a live to acetate. She's like, I didn't have a guitar. I don't have a guitar. And he's like, here it is, you know. So she goes and she sings a song, and Jack's behind the you know, two-way mirror listening. And that was it. That was the audition. And they're like, yeah, we're going to sign you, you know. And from then on, it was, and Third Man was awesome. They were behind her fully, you know. And that was the moment, like, I go back to the Beatles, that's the moment where she got her foot in the door, because her first album was, like, top 10 Billboard, and it was, like, news everywhere, you know. Like, there's this, like, outlier who's, like, kind of got in. So even though it hasn't been totally easy since then, she's been able to do whatever the hell she wants now, because she's got an audience. So it's like, you know, too late for everybody that didn't want her there. You know, as you're saying, like, once you're in the door, then
yeah,
you can't really, you know.
I think it's important too. I mean, yes, we kind of joke that do the smart thing, do the Beatles route, get your foot in the door, and then have a creative voice, so to speak. Yeah. But I do also think it's wildly important to live in a world where we have people like yourself that say, no, this is what I'm doing. And if the rest of the world isn't interested in that yet, well, fuck you. That's your problem. Yeah. I think we need that in the world. I think I think we need people like yourself to be able to, because suffering through that is no small feat in life. And yeah, people do that. And for myself, those are the people that I find immense respect for, who are willing to do that because they think that that's what they need to do. When you're going through things like that, I mean, that's a large swath of your life. What is it that besides obsession, besides just that sort of primal feeling of, I need to do this. Mm-hmm. What is the thing that you're, what is that point of enjoyment that you're, or enjoyment may not be the best term, but what's that part of, what's the positive that you're getting out of that thing in your life?
Well, we call it the new song high, you know. And recording an album is fun, but I think we all know this, if you record an album, you go through, you write it first, and then you go, you teach it to some musicians, and then you record it, and then you mix it, and then you master it. We're talking about months of the same nine to ten songs. And you might love it when you write it. So I figured this out after years and years. I think the only enjoyment, the real enjoyment for me, is when the song's done and I love it. That's it.
Yeah.
Because once it's recorded, and once I actually am going to put it out, I can't hear it anymore. It drives me crazy. It's like, you know that scene, y'all see the Love and Mercy, the biopic of Brian Wilson?
Yeah, I've not seen it, but I've heard good things about it.
Well, John Cusack plays, it's really good, but John Cusack plays older Brian Wilson, and there's a scene where he's on a boat, he's with a girl, he's kind of like flirting with the girl, and the guy, the only other person on the boat is the guy, the captain of the boat, kind of giving them the the little chip out to see. And he starts playing Sloop John B. And then Brian's like trying to talk to the girl. He's like, oh my God. He's like, hey, can you turn that off? And he's like, oh, I'm just playing it because I love you. He's like, it's kind of wrecking my brain, man. You know, yeah. It's like, so sometimes I'll be going through, doesn't happen often, but I'll be going through like the grocery store or, places like Cracker Barrel, I like to play Margot. But I'll be like just doing something. And then like a few notes or something comes on. And I at first don't know what it is. I'm just like, I just immediately, my body, my nervous system's like, fuck this. I have a focus on why I don't like it. I'm like, I don't like this chord progression. I don't like the way. And then she starts singing. I'm like, oh, that's Margot. Okay, yeah. Like,
that's a good song. I just had a little bit of a reaction.
I know what I went through to get, so yeah, I was part of every step. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah. I think the most enjoyable part is when you get done with the composition and you know it's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that to me sure. is.
Yeah. And that sort of pride in a well done.
I do enjoy when an album comes out, whether it be on a small scale like my stuff or a bigger scale like Margot's. I do like before it comes out and you send it to a buddy, you're like, hey, check this out. Mm-hmm. And you wait for about 30 minutes, and then you start getting a couple dots hey, this is really good.
Oh, here we go.
When my friends like it, then I get satisfaction out of that. And sometimes this is a really dorky thing I'll do sometimes. Album's done, I'm going to send it to you. Like, hey, you want to hear it? He's like, yeah, I'd love to. I'll send it. And as soon as I know that you're playing it, I'll play it too and listen to think, like, think through your ears.
What's he thinking? Yeah, right now.
Is he like this part, So is there like live texting me? I'm like at the same song. I'm like, oh, yeah, I hear that. It's cool.
Yeah. That's funny.
That's just me being honest.
No, but that's great, though. I love that.
Yeah.
I think with songwriting too, or with music, it's. I think we can wrap our mind around, or most people who aren't in the music world, they can wrap their mind around the fact that, okay, if a movie's coming out, they shot the movie a year and a half ago, there's post-production, they've got to edit it, and then, movie comes out, those actors, directors, whomever, they're working on another project. With music, I think the way most people process that is the turnaround must be 5 seconds, right? Yeah. It's just music, so they must think, okay, well, this album came out last year. This must be brand spanking new stuff for you. Meanwhile, you've been working on this for three and a half years now. It's like, and that's something I think is really strange. I don't know why there's that disconnect in music where people feel like it's a much more immediate thing, whereas the turnaround is comparable to pretty much any other.
I think it's the same. I mean, maybe some people are more hip to the movie thing, but I think a lot of people aren't. Because I remember people talking about, why is Timothée Chalamet's hair like that when he was, promoting the Bob Dylan movie?
Yeah.
Because he's filming something else, you idiots. Like, he's not no longer playing Bob Dylan.
You're probably right, yeah.
And I think people have no idea. They're like, hey, we're going to play a new song off your record that came out a year ago. It's like, not a new song. 3-4 years old.
It's new to you.
Yeah. We just completed the album that you're not going to hear for another year. It's like that kind of thing. And it's always a little bit annoying where I think by the time you get done with an album, and if you're a touring musician, you get through the year of promoting that album, you're playing the songs a lot. Well, here's the thing. We were playing them before we recorded them because we were testing out which ones the audience, people liked, and which ones worked and didn't like, So to us, it's actually way older. So by the time you get done with that, promotional run of those same songs, you're like, can't play them anymore, I go back to Ellie Smith because I'm a fan, but, there's a great clip of him playing XO, which is that waltz, whatever. It's kind of popular. He's playing it after his tour of it, after he'd done all his promotion for it, and he stops in the middle. It's like a big thing, I forget what radio station, but it was a big station. Mm-hmm. He stops in the middle of it. It's being filmed, He's like, I can't play it. Why? He's like, I play it too many times. It doesn't mean anything to me. We're like, well, we like it, so play it. It's like, it doesn't matter if you like it. It means nothing to me. It's like saying spaghetti too many times. You don't know what the word means anymore. And there is a little bit of that. Once you're done promoting a record, those songs are your mortal enemies. It's like saying the same word too many times and you don't know what it means.
And it's hard to recreate that same spark you had when you wrote it.
And some people can, this is where my favorite artistry comes into play. Some people can keep that fresh. Some people can just through approach and creativity find ways of coming at that song from a different angle.
Yeah.
And obviously we see this, it's the entire world of jazz, right? People can people can approach those creative ideas from different angles and bring something beautiful and new to it. And that's, for myself, I think, songwriting aside, that's probably the thing in music that I'm most in awe of, is when people can have that that creative mind that can allow you to sit with something in that way and constantly reinvent. For you, if you had to pick your sort of Mount Rushmore of artists, I mean, inside music, outside music, who are the people that really have influenced you in your life?
I mean, it's just what I've... Bob Dylan is probably the most influential as far as any sort of lyricism. And the Beatles, too, because that was something... So I was raised in a very religious home, and I wasn't allowed to listen to really anything secular. So it was like... I really got into Beethoven. It was either classical or Christian. Mm-hmm. And I recognized pretty early that classical musically, like, got to me more than Christian musically, you know. I liked old hymns and stuff, but as far
did you feel the sandbox was bigger? Like, what was it about classical music that...
It just the movements of it, the the musicality of it was broader, you know. Also, going back to what I was talking about before, the reason that Beethoven appealed to me was because there was depression. There was a darkness to it. Christian music obviously didn't have depressing songs.
Yeah.
It's not part of that
genre. It's all supposed to be uplifting.
Yeah, even if it's like, oh, we're sad because Jesus died, but then he arose.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
There's always a happy ending to it. So I'd live with that for a while, and I remember I would sometimes get like recordings of things, and if my parents found out, they would get rid of them or get in trouble, you know. And I think I would tape stuff in the 90s off like radio, and I would keep like these little mixtapes and... So I had that, but I think the first album I was allowed to get, like, okay, you can have this, was Rubber Soul. And I'd only before heard, like, early Beatles stuff, so that was kind of, like, a little bit of a revelation to me.
Was it jarring to you to hear that?
It was great. It was, like, it was, to me, using those classical changes. Let's say, like, you know, in my life, the four minor, that's something I heard in classical music, but I didn't hear, you know, really in pop stuff. Or at that point, anything on the radio in the 90s wasn't doing the four minor. Stuff like that, you know. Actually, I think one of the songs I played was as a prominent four minor. But
it's a good chord, so.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, those basic things that everyone would say are kind of true for me. And it wasn't until later I started getting into things like, in the songwriter world of, like, the John Prines and, you know, I think I got into John Prine because I got a cassette at a thrift store that said Prine Prime, and I was like, what does that mean? And it was just like kind of the greatest hits of, and that changed my perspective. Simon Garfunkel too, because that was another thing I was only allowed like this small list of things that my parents deemed like wholesome, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Simon Garfunkel was wholesome, but the cool thing about that is those early Simon Garfunkel records, they were totally, the voices were absolutely panned. So you had Paul on the right and you had Art on the left. So that's how I learned how to do harmonies. So I'd just listen to Art's part and I would memorize it. And turn Paul's back on, I would sing Art's part. I'm like, well, that's how harmony works, you know?
That's beautiful.
Which I think is a cool thing that they panned them that way.
It makes it really easy to hear.
The students of harmony can be like, okay.
Yeah.
Because when you're first learning, harmony doesn't make any sense. You're like,
all kind of blurs together.
The melody's like bum bum bum, you know.
Yeah.
But if you're like, you know, you got to do like a like what is that? That's not this melody, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've tried to explain this that when Margaret was first learning harmony, she was like, I don't get what you're talking about, because she always was such a strong lead vocalist that she'd only thought about melody, and I was like, just think of the wrong note, sing the wrong note, you know. And then she started. Now she's really good at it, you know.
That's a great way to articulate
the
that, actually.
It's still kind of in the key, but it's not the right
note. It's not the note I was supposed to be saying, but it didn't sound bad. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great way of putting it.
But, that was what got me into all that. And to be honest, it would just be Beatles, Bob Dylan, and Beethoven. The three B's, you know.
I'm going to be honest, that's a pretty good Mount Rushmore right there. So it's hard to compete with. I was actually just thinking about this as I asked you that. One of the folks on my Mount Rushmore we just lost recently, and we haven't really talked about it, but Todd Snyder we lost very recently.
Yeah.
And I don't even really have much to say on it other than the fact that it feels very strange that he's gone. And there's a lot of songwriters in my life that I've looked up to, and his songwriting is I think if in any, again, I think this transcends songwriting. In any form of art, if you can present something into the world that is unequivocally yours, mm-hmm. I think that's in a lot of ways the highest honor you can give something. And one of the things that I just kind of want to speak it into the world, because I don't frankly know how else to convey this, but you can hear two lines from a Todd Snyder song and you know that's who wrote that song. And I wish there was more people who made stuff that could get to that place, because it's such a hard place to get to.
Yeah.
And he's one of those guys that I'm just, not to, you know, bring the mood down, but I'm just incredibly sad that we don't have him anymore.
Well, one thing I'd say about him too is he's one of the dangerous ones. The reason that he was never in the mainstream is because there's songs that he has that are jarringly honest, you know. So no one, you know, the gatekeepers aren't going to let that.
Oh, yeah, there's no way.
That crazy man in. But I really liked him as a friend, as an artist. You know, the thing I've started learning, which I probably should have learned a long time ago because it's just what the nature of life. But, you know, we were good friends with John Prine when he passed, too. So sometimes you'll see people and you just take for granted that you're going to see him again. And I saw Todd, like, right before that happened, he was at the Ryman singing with Margo for the John Prine tribute, the You Got Gold, and they did In Spite of Ourselves together. And he was upstairs in the green room with Margo, and I went up there and joked around with him. He was having a lot of back pain, talking about that. But we had this whole plan to, me and Margo and Todd were supposed to write when he got off the road, which would have been next month in January. And it'd been a thing where he reached out to Margo and said, hey, I keep forgetting that we need to hang, we need to do, you know, be in each other's lives more. And so that's the thing that stings, is that there was a plan, there would have been songs, there would have been times, and you just don't think of it every time that when you see anyone, that it possibly could be the last thing that you say to them or do with them. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting to the point, and I know the fact that the older you get, the more people you lose, that's just how it goes. But in the past, like, 7 or 8 years, I've lost maybe 3 or 4 people that were close. And it's, I'm trying to live in the moment. I'm trying to, like Warren Zevon said, enjoy every sandwich. Enjoy every interaction you have with people around you, because, yeah, I had no idea. I went to D's a couple of days after seeing him. And then I ran into a buddy who was like, we don't know for sure, but I think Todd's, like, in big trouble. I didn't know the story. I didn't know what's going on. And I mean, I was like, trouble how? I was like, I don't know if he's going to make it. And there was that portion of the experience. And then it was like maybe 6 hours later, it was like announced online, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. The only lesson to be learned is, one, write songs like Todd Snyder. Two is just drink in your interactions with people, because they're all finite. And even you, mm-hmm. you're finite, so... You know, hopefully, if there's anything good that comes with losing someone that's great, is that they'll look at you the same way and you'll treat each other like the thing that you're doing is more precious than you realize, because it's, that's the best thing about death, and there is something good about it, is what I was saying, the happy and sad, you don't appreciate one without the other. Mm-hmm. If we live forever, I mean, it's funny having kids, because you have to explain this, you know. I think only recently, maybe, you know, my daughter's 6, so maybe around 4. She's pretty smart, so she started getting onto it. She's like, I'm going to die, you're going to die, everyone's going to die. It's like, yeah. And then she's like, I don't want to die. I'm like, well, I get that. You know, I don't want to either. But let me tell you this, something that you don't understand yet. You do not want to live forever. That shit would suck. Think about being like 9,000 years old. You're like, it, more this, like, yeah, yeah. More, like, you know, I eat, I shit, I sleep, like 9,000, you know, like, I'm sorry, but there's an end that we all come to. Yeah. And I think when our body starts to fail in a natural way, and we're in our mid late 80s, I think all of us have that. I say us, I haven't been there yet, but I feel like it's true.
Yeah.
This thing, like, I'm kind of ready. I think I've done the thing. I've done all the things.
You've experienced enough of
life. I've experienced gravity. I've eaten the apple. I've walked to the store. I got bunions. I did all the human things. I got it. I petted a dog. And
yeah.
Yeah.
At some point, you're like, I can't do this forever, because I'm not going to be able to find joy in it forever, you know?
Totally.
Yeah, and I think there's something to just recognizing that and recognizing that. It's kind of like what Brian was saying earlier today. You need that contrast. You need that. That's the reason why we can't have all sad songs. We can't have all happy songs. It's just, the way life. Like I only met, and this is obviously a much less impactful story. I only met Todd one time. I went to go see him in Boston when we lived there with a buddy of mine. And after the show, this is back when I smoked cigarettes. We were just hanging out down the street, having a cigarette, talking about how great the show was and probably what show we were going to go play that night. And he came walking down the street with his dog, and we talked to him for a minute. I was telling him at that point that we were thinking about moving to Nashville. And he said, yeah, come out there, come find me sometime. It's for whatever reason, it's stupid, but it's stuck in my head for all these years. Cause I think, he was just here. He was here and, mm-hmm. and it's strange that he's not. But I'm really glad that we've got folks that still are doing this for the right reasons, and we're always gonna have people who do this for the right reasons and who want to just keep making music because they're obsessed with it and that they love doing it. I appreciate you coming out here and doing this so much, man. Like, this has been a ball just to hear. The songs are beautiful. I can't wait for everyone to hear this stuff because they sound fantastic. But thank you so much. I love it. I love it. Awesome. Well, thank you guys for watching too. That was so great. Yeah.